Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I am going to actually teach the lesson today. I'm standing in for... Oh, you're back there. You're here today. Oh, okay. Patrick's here. Actually, Patrick had... This was a big week for his dissertation work, and so he needed the time, and so he asked if I would do the Bible class today. Or, I'm sorry, the Bible class. I'm used to doing that. The sermon today, and I'm happy to have this chance to do that. Today... we're going to do one of the most famous stories in the Bible. If you were in Sunday school as a kid, this was probably one of the first big stories you learned. I mean, you had the flood because of the animals. How many people remember flannel graphs? Yeah, thank you. All the older people can raise their hands. Yeah, because flannel graphs. You know, it's a piece of flannel, and they would have cutouts and put it on there, and then they would tell the story and move the characters around and so forth. And David and Goliath was one of them. I said to Patrick, I said, wow, this one's been done to death. you know, I mean, who doesn't know the story of David and Goliath? Anybody here not know the story of David and Goliath? Okay, we're done. I mean, really, you know, it is one of the great stories. And this whole series, by the way, that Patrick has been preaching through is called Ordinary People, Extraordinary God. And... So, you know, and often this story is told of David being just this shepherd boy who comes on the scene to do something absolutely miraculous, something amazing. And, you know, it was good, though, that we're going to do this lesson today because it's been a while since I've read it. And so I want to read through it. So open your Bibles, if you would, to the book of 1 Samuel, and we are in chapter 17. 1 Samuel 17. And I'm just going to read the story first, just to tell it again, because it's a rich piece of history and an amazing story of God's triumph. There's no question about it. So now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes-Damim between Succoth and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle lines to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with the valley between them. I want to stop right here because this picture is, this rendering that's on the screen here is actually pretty accurate. This area of Israel is actually is a series of passes that run kind of from the Mediterranean up into the hill country through Judah and into Judah. And so there are ridges that run along the side. And so literally you had a ridge on one side, a valley, and then a ridge on the other, and there were several of these. This is where they drew up, and you can actually see the army in the background there. That's obviously the Philistine side, and the Israelites would be obviously on David's side over here. And they kind of just sat there on the hill, and I'm going to explain why this location was kind of interesting for this particular, I'm going to use the word battle in quotes. So now, picking up in verse 4, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistines, On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second was Abinadab, and the third was Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul. But David at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take an ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them." There was Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. Early in the morning, David left the flock in the care of a shepherd, loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brothers how they were. As they were talking with them, Goliath the Philistine, champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes in Israel." Wow. I mean, you're set for life. That's like winning the lottery. You know, it's amazing. David asked the man standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This is what we've done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him. And he asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I am not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come after me with sticks?" Referring to the shepherd's staff. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I will give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel." All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the sheath. After he had killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the great gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Sha'arim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. He put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent. As Saul watched David going out to meet the Philistines, he said to Abner, commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is that young man?" So there you have it. Pretty amazing story. Before we break it down, I thought it would be interesting to spend a little time talking about a little of the history of this and what actually some of the facts around the story. This map gives you a sense of what the kind of the nations were around Israel. The red over there on the Mediterranean coast is actually the Philistine states. They were people that had come from Crete and had settled there. And they were always kind of a thorn in the flesh of the Israelites. But what was interesting, and Patrick touched on this last week in the story of Deborah, you can see all the other kingdoms around them, you know, Edom and Aram and others that are there, and Ammon. And so this was interesting in that these were all the nation states that caused problems for Israel. On and off through the histories that we read in books like Samuel and Chronicles and so forth. So Philistines were obviously one of those. And what's interesting is you can kind of see this movement from the red into the kind of that darkish pink. That's Judah. And so that's where those valleys and ridges were that I was telling you about that ran from the west there on the Mediterranean east into the land of Judah, and that's where this battle took place. So it kind of gives you a picture that there were people around them that did not like them, did not like the Israelites, and they had designs on wanting to conquer them. So how old was David? Most scholars would put David at about age 16 at this time. And this is where the flannel graph is kind of funny back from Sunday school days, because sometimes they portrayed him as almost a little boy, you know, and that's kind of not really true based on the records and what we know. For example, by his own words, he killed lions and bears. So this is not some little kid. It's just a beggar's belief that, say, an eight-year-old could do that. So he obviously was strong enough and big enough to carry that off. The other interesting thing was, in other records, you know that the age of conscription for the armies of Israel was about age 20. And so you know that his older brothers were with Saul's army. So they were 20 or older, and including the oldest. Okay, and so this kind of sets that he probably was somewhere around 15 or 16 years old. How big was Goliath? Well, it says 6 cubits and a span. So 6 cubits and a span. Most scholars would say a cubit. And if you remember this, if anybody remembers this from your Bible classes, a cubit, it's from the tip of your middle finger down to your elbow right here, that's about a cubit. About 18 inches, 17 and a half, 18 inches is a cubit. Okay? And a span, got to hold this down. A span is the span of your hand. So from the tip of your thumb to the tip of your little finger. It's about 8 inches or so, okay? Now, I want to just say something here, though. It's a little squishy because cubit, while we kind of hold about an 18-inch, it's not necessarily always the same across all references in literature, okay? And Lisa and I did a little experiment yesterday. We got out the tape measure and we measured. She is the perfect cubit. She has 18 inches from her middle finger to her elbow. I am 20 inches from here to my elbow. See, so it's not an exact measure. But we'll hold to the 18 and the span of the hand. That would put him at about 9 feet, 9 inches tall. Now, there have been estimates in the biblical scholars and others who have said it's anywhere, he could have been anywhere from 7 feet 11 to somewhere around that 10-foot mark. Okay. We have at least one record of modern history, and he's in the Guinness Book. He's the tallest human in the Guinness Book of World Records. I think it still stands as far as I know. Robert Wadlow, he's from the United States. He was 8 feet 11 inches tall. And that's modern history. And we know that in biblical record there were, you know, people that were, you know, like Methuselah lived to 900 and some years. You know, those kinds of things that are extraordinary. So we believe that I take it that Goliath was a big guy. You know, he was huge. You know, and you can kind of get that from when they describe his armor, how much his armor weighed. He had to be a big guy to weigh that much armor. Okay, this is an important one. Oftentimes people think it's a slingshot, the little kid's toy. No, it was not a slingshot. This was an actual sling. Example shown there, leather cords or woven cords, usually a leather pouch or a woven pouch to hold the stone. You can see the example in the bottom right there. It's literally slung kind of over the head, if you will, to gain speed, then one string is let go, and then the projectile goes out. You can see the 5 smooth stones there. Why would you use smooth stones, do you think? Fly better. Exactly. They fly better. They're more aerodynamic. They're in bullet speak, they're ballistically sound. They fly better and better. Okay. Cliff had, and I had a good conversation about this, he shared something very interesting. In archaeology now in the Middle East, they are finding lead balls from ancient times. Lead and what was the other? I think you said one other material. But anyway, at least lead for sure. They're lead balls, and what they're finding is those were sling projectiles. They weren't just using stones. They were using lead balls as a projectile. Now, in researching this, getting ready for this class, I also did something else. I looked this up. You had the infantry. These are the people who go down into the valley to fight man-to-man. Okay, so swords, sometimes spears, usually swords, daggers, those kinds of things. Okay, you had the cavalry. Cavalry most often was what? ancient times? Chariots, right? Horses or chariots, probably chariots. That was the cavalry, and those were the, what they call them, shock troops. Their job is to drive into a forest, break it up, and scatter it. Okay, that's their job. Or flank around and come in from behind and attack them that way. So the cavalry. In ancient times, anybody know what the artillery was? Now, artillery we think of today as big cannons or things that, that hurl explosives. But what do you think the artillery was back in that day? Catapult would be a good guess, but archers. Archers were the artillery. You'd have whole banks of hundreds of people with arrows. They would often they'd shoot very high, let them arc over, and then hit the enemy. Okay. What most people don't know is there were also slingers. Not the city in Wisconsin. Slingers who actually were armed with these devices that you see on the screen here. And this then supports a lot of what Cliff was saying is, you know, they use projectiles. Now, here's the thing. When you're using a sling, David's aim was fantastic. Many will say God directed the rock right where it went. But the point is that you'd say, like, would somebody get hit with that and go, ow? No, they would not go, ow. It would be pretty devastating. For example, yes, David killed Goliath with it, but oftentimes all you had to do was break a bone. And in military speak, they become combat ineffective. The person who gets hit can't fight anymore. You break their arm, their sword arm with a rock, they can't fight. And so they've got to get off the field. It reduces the numbers. So it was a very effective weapon. David probably used it in his shepherding, you know, to scare off lions, bears, wolves, you name it. So it was a very effective tool for him to use. Another fact of the story. Single combat was not uncommon. What Goliath challenged him to come down to do was called single combat. One champion from one army, champion from another army, they come down into the valley and they fight, or come out onto the field and they fight. And the one that wins, they become the victor, and the one that loses, that army becomes, and that nation becomes subject to the victor. Okay, so this was a pretty common thing, and really, to be honest with you, you could kind of understand why they might want to do this, because bloodshed, these battles were all battle, okay. General Sherman in the Civil War said, war is hell. And he was right. It is a bloody thing. And these were horrible battles. Just horrible. You know, bloodshed like you would not believe. And so you can almost see where the generals say, or the kings say, yeah, we'll do single combat because then we don't kill everybody off. You know, that type of thing. So this was a very common thing that one champion faces another champion who wins. They become the victor and the others become subject to them. So, now back to the story. We take away the lesson of the story here, and we certainly admire David's heroic courage. We always remember that it's God who enabled him to overcome and win, and more importantly, to embolden the Israelites to then chase the Philistines and rout them and literally kill them off. So that's the end. End of the story. David steps forward. God gives him the courage and the power and the victory. End of story, right? Or is it? Remember our theme. Ordinary people, extraordinary God. When I was looking at this story and I said, you know, it's been done to death. We've done it so much. We know it so often. What's another way we can look at this story? Is there another moral? And then I asked this question. What if we all can't be a David? Because that's often what we're taught. And that's not a bad thing. Don't hear me saying it's a bad thing. But we're often taught, be David. Be like David. think I may have. Oh, okay, good. Thank you. What if we look at the other people in this story? You know, this is one of the beauties of the Bible, is that God doesn't just, he tells a story, but it's so rich because you have to think of it in layers. You have to dig a little bit and look at it in another way, and all of a sudden you gain a whole new perspective. And from this, we might gain insight into our human nature. And we might actually see that there's a remedy for some of our human failings. So, there are four specific things I want to just focus on here. First of all, the army and the people of Israel. There is no other word for this. They were terrified. They were scared. And again, I said because the battles of those days were horrible. The victors were brutal. The victors were brutal on those that they defeated. And they were brutal on the people then that became subject to them. And so there's no question that that's a very human thing. I don't think in our day we have necessarily faced that kind of terror or that kind of fear. Probably the closest we've come recently might be COVID. If you think about it, some of us, you know, I mean, there's some pause there. You know, it's like, this could be really horrible. And it was. So if you just kind of try that on for a minute and say, yeah, you know, when COVID first started going, you know, it's like, that was pretty scary stuff. You know, I'm not saying I'm panicked or fearful, but it's scary. Now put the shoes on of these people who are standing there. The soldiers themselves who had to face the battle, and probably their lives are going to be forfeit as a result. And then the people that they were protecting, the people of Israel, they're afraid too. Next one, David's brother. He is angry. He's degrading. He's certainly discouraging. He's almost treating him like the kid brother you didn't want to have hanging around. Dismissive. Just go back. What did you come here to just see the battle? You know? Why are you bothering us? And I know how conceited you are. It's a very interesting statement he made, how conceited you are. Anybody got a guess as to why he might have been lashing out at David?
One thing, David was too young to be part of this. And it's like when your brother has to get a calf, he's drilled and you say, don't be a baby.
That's good. That's good. That's good, Danny.
The brother might have been the ugly duckling, or he might have been dad's favorite.
That's a good point. Yeah. Ugly duckling, your dad's favorite. Yeah, that's true. These are all good and very human things that you guys are bringing up. You know, they're very real. Here's one that sometimes we don't get the chronology right, but if you go back and look it up, it also becomes crystal clear. Remember, we're in 17, 1 Samuel 17. Go back to 1 Samuel 16. God tells Samuel, I have rejected Saul. By the way, Saul got rejected because Saul took it upon himself to offer sacrifices. He stepped in the role of the priest. That's a big no-no. And God, that was it. God was done with him. He's rejected Saul. And Samuel's mourning, and God says to Samuel, how long are you going to mourn this guy? Get up, get your flask of oil. I'm going to pick a new king. Now, here's why I love this picture, because it's just amazing, this painting. You see who's standing in the background? The brothers. You remember the story, what happened? Samuel went through every one of the brothers, starting with the oldest. And they stood before Samuel, and God told Samuel, nope, not him. He gets through all the brothers, and Samuel asks the question, is there one more? Isn't there any other child? Well, there's the youngest. He's out with the flocks. Samuel says, go get him. And they bring David forward, and God says to Samuel, that's him. Anoint him. He's going to be the king. Look who's looking over the shoulder, looking off in the distance to see this happen. Now, why would Eliab the oldest, why would he be upset? Why might he be upset? What's the culture? The oldest son, the culture, the oldest son was the favored son. So he's probably thinking, why not me? And now David shows up at the battle, and he's asking, what will happen if somebody kills this guy, what happens? He's figuring it out. David's figuring it out, and Eliab's going, oh, here he goes. He's going to try to be the big hero. But behind all this, I think he was jealous. I think he was envious. And that's why he lashed out and tried to get him, get out of here, go home. Two more on Saul. Saul's assessment of David's prowess. I love that word, prowess. From Webster's, it's distinguished bravery or extraordinary ability or both. Saul tells David, you can't stand up against this guy. You're a kid, basically. You're a kid. This guy is a trained warrior. He's a trained warrior. He has battle experience. And you hear about this in modern military history when under-equipped, ill-trained soldiers go up against an army that's really trained, well-equipped. You know what happens. I'm sorry, the classic example, but it's true. Germany against France, Germany against Poland in World War II. They ran over them. They just were not ready for battle. And so Saul looks at David and goes, you won't be able to stand up against this guy. But David convinces him. Saul says, all right, well, you're going up against this guy with all this armor on and a javelin and a spear and a sword. We better dress him up. So he gives him his armor. Saul's going to give him his armor. There's a problem. Saul was a big man, bigger than most. They said a head and shoulders taller than the average person in Israel. So Saul's armor is going to be bigger. It's going to be heavier. And in some ways it's an honor. Saul's saying, here, take my armor. You know, at least put this on so you're ready to go. I found this cartoon. I think it's really funny. I think David might have likely thought, hey, thanks, but do you have anything in a 32 slim? Said another way, Saul's armor came from the big and tall shop, but David was neither big or tall. Now, important thing too here, David, I think, you know, Cliff said this in class, you know, the people in ancient times were smart. I think David was smart. Here's the thing. If Saul was 9 feet 9 inches tall and he's covered in armor, and David puts on Saul's armor and David can't move, what did David figure out? If I get off this armor, I can move around this guy, this big guy who's got all this armor on. I can get around him. Maneuver, in military terms, maneuver is the way to victory, because if you can move around, you're not a sitting target. And so David knew he could move quicker and move around this big, lumbering, 9-foot, 9-inch guy covered in armor. So he takes the armor off. And we know the rest of the story. Picks up stones from a creek or the stream at the bottom of the valley, runs up and defeats him. Doesn't just defeat him. He hits him in the forehead. I was talking to somebody, I don't want to overstate the medical here, but he obviously induced some serious head trauma and then kills him. May have had to finish him off, if you want to say it this way, but then cuts his head off. That was a very prominent thing in that day, was to take the head. It became a trophy. And as I was thinking about this story, I said, maybe if we can all be like David, maybe we can at least try to be a little less like the other people in the story. For example, don't give in to the fear, but trust in the living God. I'm honest. I look back to COVID in the first days. I wasn't terrified, but there were days. And you had to pray to God and just help me do it. Please be with those that have it. Please be with those who are having loved ones that they're losing through it. Here's another one. Guard against jealousy and envy and bitterness. And trust in the living God. It's so easy for us to look at those that have and those that do not. Or those that are gifted in certain ways that we don't have. But if we give in to the jealousy and the envy and the covetousness and the bitterness, it just destroys you. So trust in the living God. Here's another one. Don't judge your preparedness with human eyes, but trust in the living God. I mean, how many times do you say, oh, I could never evangelize to someone? I'm guilty. You know? I wouldn't know what to say. I'm not prepared. I don't have enough Bible. The list goes on and on and on. We can all come up with reasons. So we're all using our own yardstick to measure. But if we trust in the living God, He guides the outcome. And finally, I was reminded of this line from Psalms 20, verse 7. Some trust in chariots and horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Extra points for anybody who can tell me what that picture is from. Ben-Hur. Thank you, Linda got it first. Who's the actor? Charlton Heston. Thank you. Who played Moses in an earlier movie, by the way? Yeah, Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston. Yeah, this by the way, this scene was enacting the Circus Maximus in Rome. This is where this chariot race was held. But I chose this verse because it's important. Chariots were a real terror weapon. People were just afraid of them because they, like I called them, the shock troops. But here's the point. What David wrote here. You trust in these things, you ain't trusting in God. And for us today, we don't have chariots. We don't have body armor. We don't have long guns and rifles to fight the battle. Please, if you would, open your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 6. Very interesting that Paul used this beautiful analogy to explain how we can be prepared. Beginning in chapter 10, finally, be strong in the Lord and in His mighty power. That, friends, synopsizes the story of David and Goliath. be strong in the Lord and in His mighty power. And for all of us, put on the full armor of God. This is not armor like Goliath wore or that Saul tried to give to David. The difference is this armor is spiritual. What God knows and what He taught us through Paul is that our battles are spiritual. And therefore our weapons have to be spiritual. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. I want to stop there. Do you see the picture that is being painted here? We tend to look at the spiritual as some kind of ethereal, cloud-like, misty thing that goes on out there. But the battle is real. And the enemy is real. When Satan fell, a third of the stars in the heavens fell with him. What that reference is that that's how many demons went with him. The battle is real. The war is real. Our fight is not against flesh and blood. Therefore, verse 13, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you've done everything, to stand. What that says is, you'll be alive. You'll be victorious. After you've done everything, you'll be able to stand. Stand firm then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist. What is the truth? The Word. A belt. Belts were used to cinch up and tighten and strengthen. With the breastplate of righteousness. Love the analogy. It's a beautiful picture. Breastplate of righteousness. How do we get the breastplate of righteousness? How do we get that? Jesus Christ. He is our righteousness. And with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation. Who handed us the helmet of salvation? Jesus Christ. And the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the Lord's people. He then asks them to pray for him as well. Remember when I did the Lord's Supper a couple weeks ago, I talked about the arc of the story? How God has written the arc of the story? It's amazing that we have this great story of David and his victory with God's help over the enemy. And you've come forward several hundreds, if not thousands of years to Paul. And Paul talks about a battle and about what we need to be ready to have the victory. So here's my point. We're all ordinary people. Not all of us are gifted. I've started to call Patrick the son of thunder because he thunders from the pulpit. Not all of us are Patrick that can preach with such power and eloquence. We all have a role, right? So, we're all ordinary people. But we can be victorious and we can do good for the kingdom and for the king because we serve an extraordinary God. That should give us great joy. And so if you would, let's stand as we sing and close out this sermon today.